It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get a sneak peek at what's new this season on Wisconsin Public Television's Wisconsin Life.
First, state lawmakers have proposed a bill that would allow anyone to build on certain wetlands in Wisconsin without a permit. Yesterday, Republican Senator Roger Roth, a co-sponsor of that bill, said that the bill includes steps to ensure that there's no loss of wetlands in the state.
To mitigate, that means that the DNR will let you fill that in, but in place of doing that, they're going to require that you mitigate that or create another wetland at a higher ratio, anywhere between 1.2 and 1.7 to 1, somewhere else within the watershed or the state. So it's important for everyone to know that under this bill, there is no net loss of wetlands here in the state of Wisconsin.
But environmentalists fear that the provisions in the bill to protect wetlands elsewhere would not go far enough.
Erin O'Brien is with us now. She's the Policy Programs Director for the Wetlands, Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Erin, what was your first reaction to this proposal?
Well, the very first reaction was surprise because we didn't know it was coming, and it snuck up on us on a Friday afternoon. And then I'd say disappointment because we weren't consulted on the provisions of the bill, and it's a fairly extreme proposal as it currently stands.
How do you see the proposal as it stands affecting wetlands here in Wisconsin?
Well, the impacts are substantial because what the bill does is it removes and completely eliminates protections for about 20% of the wetlands in the state, and that's a conservative estimate. And it would affect no less than and probably significantly more than 1 million acres of the state's wetlands.
We just heard from Senator Roth. He was on our program yesterday, and he was pointing out that the bill as it stands allows for some mitigation there for wetlands to be created if there is a wetland filled in or restored elsewhere. Is that enough?
No, it's not enough, unfortunately. I mean, the first thing you have to remember when we talk about wetlands and wetland protection is that the state of Wisconsin has already lost nearly half of its historic wetlands. So we have about 5.3 million acres remaining from about 10 million acres pre-settlement. So we already feel the consequences of historic wetland losses in the state. And though it sounds reasonable to say, well, we're going to allow some fill here and we're going to restore more wetlands someplace else, the wetlands that are restored are rarely of the same quality, type or function of the ones that are lost, and they're not in the same location. And the thing that's important to know with wetlands is that they form due to the presence of water to perform certain functions. So they are where the water is and wants to go, and they develop in ways that that help manage that water. So even if we are creating more and bigger wetlands elsewhere, we're still losing valuable benefits on the landscape in the areas where the impacts occur.
When you talk about a potential loss of quality and type of wetlands when a new wetland, say, is created, what kind of quality is being lost? What's the danger that you see?
Well, you know, what's really interesting to me when listening to the bill's authors talk about this bill and your program and others is there seems to be some confusion about what these non-federal wetlands are. There seems to be the assumption that they are only in farm fields or empty lots, when in fact the kinds of wetlands that this bill affects are very diverse and very high quality. So they include forested ephemeral ponds, which are very abundant in northern Wisconsin, some bogs and other diverse, beautiful and ecologically important wetland types. And some of these types are difficult to replace. Others, like, for instance, a wooded wetland, it's almost impossible to replace them because they take, you know, it would take a lifetime for those trees to regenerate to provide the same habitat values and the same conditions as the wetlands that are lost.
Now, Senator Roth on our program yesterday said that this new legislation would put Wisconsin in line with most other states in the country, and that most don't have this level of wetlands protection at the state level, that they rely more on the federal protections for those that are adjacent to waterways. So is there a case to be made that Wisconsin is a bit of an outlier here and that this bill could bring Wisconsin back into mainstream wetlands practice?
Well, there's two things I'd like to address on that point. You know, the first is that it's not correct that there's only one or two states in the nation that have some protections on their law, on their books for isolated wetlands. One of the challenges in making the assessment of how widespread non-federal wetland or isolated wetlands protections are is that they're called different things in different locations. So one state might call them geographically isolated wetlands, another state might call them vernal pools or isolated wetlands. And so we're in the process now. We haven't had a lot of time yet since the bill was released to try to do that assessment to bring a more accurate number to the table in terms of how many states in the country actually have some measure of protection for these wetlands. But the other thing that's important when thinking about whether or if Wisconsin is an outlier is that you have to think about our unique geology and our unique landscape. So there are places in the nation, and Wisconsin happens to be one of them, where because of our history of glaciation, we happen to have a significantly higher abundance of this type of wetland in our state than in many other states in the nation. So you wouldn't necessarily need as strong of protections in a place like Texas or New Mexico or other arid places, because they just don't have the diversity and abundance of this wetland type. But we happen to have quite a bit. And the consequences of allowing those wetlands to be entirely unprotected could be substantial.
We're talking with Aaron O'Brien right now, Policy Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. We're talking about a proposed bill in the state legislature that would allow people and companies to build in certain wetlands areas without a permit. And Aaron, I think earlier you said this would affect about 20% of the wetlands in Wisconsin that weren't already protected under federal law because they were adjacent to a major waterway. 20% is, how significant is that number?
Well, the number that we hear from DNR is actually between 20 to 30%. So 20% is a conservative number. And as I mentioned earlier, the estimate is that that means not less than 1 million acres of wetlands and probably much higher than that. So a substantial portion of the state's wetlands.
Do you think it's a fair case or question to answer about whether existing state wetlands laws act as a disincentive to businesses?
Well, I think it's a fair conversation to have. And first I want to say, you know, there is a provision in the bill that speaks specifically to the case of exempting permit requirements for artificial wetlands. Those would be areas that might develop some wet characteristics as a result of human modifications, but don't really have the true history of wetlands, mostly as defined by the development of a special type of soils. So certainly, we should be having a conversation about whether or how our wetland regulations apply to those areas, and there's lots of room, I think, for discussion and improvement on that subject. And there's also room for discussion on how are our laws working? Are there ways for them to work better so that they can provide the functions they provide in terms of protective services and really, I mean, the purpose of regulations is a disincentive to causing harm to the resource. So there's always room to improve how those laws work, but refining our laws or improving their implementation is a very different thing than actually removing the protections altogether. And that's the thing that concerns us the most about this bill, is that it's being proposed sort of winner takes all without really having that dialogue of what problem are we trying to solve and what other options are available to us to address those concerns.
Could you talk a little bit about what role wetlands play in Wisconsin's ecosystem?
Sure. There's a long and a short answer to that question, because they provide a lot of benefits. With this particular type of wetland, isolated and ephemeral wetlands, they do several very important things, and it's another point that Senator Roth made that was actually not accurate. He made the assertion that these are not the wetlands that are providing flood control, and he seems to think that it's only the wetlands adjacent to our lakes, rivers, and streams that do that. And in fact, that's not correct, because these wetlands are, though they are small, they are abundant on the landscape, and they tend to be depressional in nature. And so when rain and snowmelt moves across the landscape, these wetlands capture that water. They hold it back. They let it infiltrate into the soil. And as a result, it's not all running downstream at high volume and high velocity. So all of those, those mechanics combined mean that these wetlands are incredibly important for protecting downstream communities and downstream infrastructure from flooding. And as you know, we've seen a great deal of flooding in the state of Wisconsin in recent years, and it seems to be getting worse all the time. The other two functions that I'll point out that are incredibly important are that these wetlands are highly valued for waterfowl and duck production, and they also provide year-long base flow to our cold water trout streams. So in the summer when other waterways might, where the precipitation is drying up, these wetlands are discharging cold groundwater and keeping those trout streams healthy and productive.
And Aaron, as we start to wrap up, where do you see this bill going moving forward, and what role will your organization be trying to play here?
Well, our hope is that this bill is withdrawn and that we can hit the reset button and go back to the table and talk about, again, what problem we're trying to solve and what are the best approaches that are, supportive of our economic development and business goals, but not harming resources in the process. And our organization is always available for those conversations. We are very eager to have those discussions both with legislators and proponents of this particular policy, and we hope that happens moving forward. The other thing I will say also is that we would also really like to see this legislature mm-hmm. pay some attention to other wetland needs beyond just looking at how our wetland regulations affecting businesses, because we have a lot of opportunities.
And we have to leave it there. Aaron, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye-bye.
Aaron O'Brien is the Policy Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, talking about a bill in the state legislature that would allow people and companies to build in certain wetlands areas without a permit.
The new season of Wisconsin Life starts airing this evening on Wisconsin Public Television, and the show welcomes its first ever host, Angela Fitzpatrick. Along with her new role on Wisconsin Life, Angela is a faculty member at Madison College and a professional financial educator at Summit Credit Union.
Angela Fitzgerald joins us now, along with Wisconsin Life series producer Kelly Saran. Angela, Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Angela, I want to start with you. What is the mission of Wisconsin Life?
I believe the mission of Wisconsin Life is to highlight the different people and places of our great state. There are so many amazing people doing different things that we may not even know are out there to do, different activities people can be involved in, things like that, and just highlighting those stories, showing how vast and broad and diverse we all are.
And Kelly, we play Wisconsin Life features on Central Time each week. How would you say the television show relates to the radio features that we play?
I think overall, Wisconsin Life is a real celebration of Wisconsin. So whether we do that on the radio or we do that through video and television, we really are celebrating the people and places of Wisconsin that perhaps you might see something in yourself in some of these stories, but sometimes you're introduced to something different and unique that's really special. So I think both radio and television kind of share that unity of celebration.
And how do you find these stories? I often wonder this as I watch the program or listen. I think, how do you find these incredible people and these incredible stories?
So we work with segment producers, and they find some of the stories, but a lot of their stories actually come from viewers. So we get people who watch our stories, they know somebody really special in their life, and they'll submit the stories to us. And we have a lot of those this season. John and Kate Grossman, I believe, is one of those, and many others that we have. Just people know what's special, and they want to share that with us. So it's exciting.
And Angela, you are the first host of Wisconsin Life
yes.
on Wisconsin Public Television. Mm-hmm. What made you want to reach out and go for this opportunity?
it was just a random series of events. I was hosting an event, and someone who works on your radio side, Cynthia Woodland, was like, I like your voice, I like your personality. There's a show that was looking for a host for Wisconsin Public Television. I think you should try out for it. I'm like, okay, I've never done anything like that before, but I'll try it. It sounds interesting. And that just kicked off the series of events that led me to here. So I just liked the opportunity to take advantage of something that seemed different and interesting, and to be able to kind of be the face of Wisconsin for some people is kind of cool to me.
I have to thank Cynthia for that. I didn't know that story. Yeah. That's terrific.
And we did an all-call audition, and we had lots of different people come out. But I remember Angela's tape, and she was outside in the cold. She had a headband on. She had a big jacket. And we said, there's something special about her. She'd never done television before in the past. And right away, we knew that there's something special about Angela. We were so excited to have that new freshness to Wisconsin life this season.
Oh, thank you, Kelly.
Well, let's dig into some of the segments that will be airing this season. And the environment is a big part of Wisconsin. You visited a legacy forest in the first season, this new season of Wisconsin Life. Tell us about that.
Sure. So we met a couple named John and Kate Grossman, and they actually started to plant this legacy forest. So every time they had a new child or a new grandchild, they planted a new species of plants, of trees. And so now you have this huge forest in their backyard, in their home in Sugar Camp. And yeah, it's a great clip. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it.
Let's take a listen.
You know, it's hard to believe we planted that tree.
In the spring of 1970, John and Kate Grossman planted a few rows of red pine in honor of their newborn son, Christopher.
I borrowed my dad's farm tractor and we furrowed it, you know, and did the planting that way.
2 years later, they planted more red pine for their second son, Andrew.
We thought it was neat to just start this new life parallel to these new lives otherwise starting.
John was a forester, and the trees contained a metaphor for life.
The trees that'll succeed on this piece of property will adapt to the place that they're plugged in to grow, and there are parallels to kids and young adults growing and finding their way in the world.
And what was that visit to the Grossman's land like?
Well, one of our producers, Zach Schultz, actually went out. So one of our producers did go out, and he said that it was just nice to see the whole family together. And in that piece, at the end of it, you kind of get a whole family glimpse of them. And it's just nice to get that family feel. And it's really, again, I keep coming back to a real celebration of life in Wisconsin, and that's what this piece really embodies as well. So it is a must-see.
And looking at another thing to look forward to in the new Wisconsin Life, music is a wonderful part of Wisconsin culture, and a lot of its history here is tied to our immigrant heritage. And here's part of an upcoming segment on the nickel harpa, or I guess this is a Swedish keyed harp.
The standard instrument is just over 3 feet long. The keys hang down and you press them up with your left hand. You play with a bow. There are typically just 4 strings that are played with the bow. The standard Swedish instrument, 3 of those strings have rows of keys. Then there are 12 sympathetic resonation strings. So as you play a tune, those resonation strings start to hum and it fills out the sound. So you have this acoustic instrument with built-in reverb and it's all natural.
So beautiful. Wow, that's amazing music. And Kelly, anything else you remember about that one?
I think his story is really quite amazing as well, too. He was into woodworking and got in a car accident and couldn't do some of the things he wanted to do in the past. So he actually took up the nickel harpa. His son loved it and plays it. So it is, again, just really a really unique piece to Wisconsin.
We're talking right now with Kelly Saran, series producer for Wisconsin Life, and also Angela Fitzgerald, new host of Wisconsin Life, as we get ready to welcome the new season of Wisconsin Life to Wisconsin Public Television. And let's talk about one more interview that we've got to look forward to here. And this is a preview of music and baking. Don't think about those things as going together, but I guess they do. Tell us a little bit about Curtis and Cake.
So Curtis and Cake, we met a lady in Fort Atkinson, and she is Monica O'Connell, and she was a musician, musicologist, and kind of had a second coming in life to do something different. So she opened up this bakery. Her parents love 1970s R&B, so her store is now called Curtis and Cake. So it's a real celebration of music and food and just entertainment.
Fort doesn't have a bakery, and Here I am in this position. I'm free.
So she decided to start her own business as a baker and wanted to connect it to the feeling she got from those childhood parties.
What I want to recreate is just that feeling of sort of deliciousness and welcomeness.
It made sense to Monica to name her business after music and food, so it became Curtis and Cake.
But I like the name. I like Curtis Mayfield.
The most important word in the title might be the and, because it represents how the union of music and food can create a good experience.
So these ideas of culture and of hospitality and of the and, right? So Curtis and Cake bring the music in, bring family in, all of that.
And that was baker Monica O'Connell. That sounds delicious and also really fun. I love that combination.
Yeah, and when we watch that segment, right, Angela, I mean, wow, that makes you want some of that cake that she's cooking.
Yes, I was jealous by you all that were able to taste some of her baked goods.
Ooh, so good.
They look delicious.
So good.
Well, as we get ready to, as I said, welcome the new season of Wisconsin Life, Angela, what do you hope people take away from this new season?
I hope they take away how cool our state is and the people that reflect the state's makeup and the different things that they're involved in and the different opportunities and events that they could take part in as well as residents of the state.
Sounds great. Kelly?
So Angela is a new addition to the season, so we get to travel around the state with her, and we've really gotten some really cool places. So I hope our viewers get to see some of the places that they normally wouldn't visit. Some of them is like the Bay Beach Wildlife Sanctuary in Green Bay. We go to Milwaukee for a mural tour. We go to the Olbrich Gardens in Madison, a Rocha Cree State Park where Angela gets to climb 300 feet. So you get to see Angela do some pretty fun stuff on this season.
Yes.
While meeting some really interesting people. So
right.
I hope you take that.
Rocha Cree is pretty high up there. That was a hike, huh?
It was, but it was beautiful when we arrived at the top. So it was worth it, even though it was a little bit of a struggle and the camera guys were going super fast. We're like, okay, just give us
puffing.
A second. We're a little lagging behind a little bit, but once we made it to the top, it was so worth it.
Sounds fantastic. Well, thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
You.
Angela Fitzgerald is the new host of Wisconsin Life, and Kelly Saran is a series producer on the show. Wisconsin Life airs on Wisconsin Public Television on Thursdays at 7 p.m. and on Milwaukee PBS Thursday at 7:30 p.m. Visit WPT for the full schedule for the Wisconsin Life TV series.
Coming up, a look at the latest numbers on drug arrests in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest tells us about federal funding limits on research into the impact and causes of gun violence.
First, amid the ongoing opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, a new report finds that drug users make up the bulk of arrests for drug-related crimes in the state compared to drug dealers.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you or anyone in your family gone through this in Wisconsin? What do you think? Who do you think the police should target when it comes to drug-related crimes in the state? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave us a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Keegan Kyle joins us now. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He wrote this report. Keegan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Keegan, I know you like to track the data on big news stories going on in Wisconsin. What drew you to this story about drug arrests?
Well, there's been a lot of reports about the impact of Wisconsin's drug problems. It's rising heroin use, rising opioid and prescription drug problems. There haven't been a lot of reports really about what systems in Wisconsin are doing to address that problem. So what I really wanted to examine was what are law enforcement agencies doing to address both the drug users as well as drug dealers.
And then the statistic that comes up for police agencies is the number of arrests. So big picture, Wisconsin-wide, what did you find when you looked at arrest numbers related to drug crimes?
So the number of drug arrests for drug possession have been gradually rising over the past decade, which shouldn't be a surprise given a lot of other data that's out there about drug use in the state. What is a little more surprising is that the number of arrests for drug sales has stayed pretty consistent over the, in recent years, and is actually down from a decade ago. So while the number of arrests for sales or possession have gone up, sales has gone down.
And you talked to people with police departments around the state. We've heard from the Attorney General about these issues. What kind of explanations did you hear for that lack of an increase in arrests for drug sales?
Sure. Two of the most common explanations were that police are going after major suppliers these days, so they are more likely to kind of arrest big fish rather than a lot of little small fish. We also heard that it's increasingly challenging for law enforcement agencies to arrest drug dealers because of the drug trade becoming increasingly sophisticated. In other cases, we also heard law enforcement agencies say that they are having resource problems created by overdose deaths or staffing issues, and that was taking time away from going after more proactive efforts like drug dealers.
So police might be having to respond to so many Narcan calls and overdose calls that they're not having time to perform longer-term investigations?
Exactly. The number, particularly with fatal overdoses, require a lot of investigation to try to understand what happened, and that can take away time from understanding this broader drug network and how it's operating in the community.
We're talking to Keegan Kyle from USA Today Network Wisconsin, talking about his report on drug arrest trends in Wisconsin. As drug problems increase, arrests of users have gone up, but dealers, not necessarily. We're looking for some of the reasons behind that. And Keegan, you talked about the increasing sophistication of the drug dealers and the networks involved in this. It seems like, from reading your report, maybe police were able to get the low-hanging fruit, the sort of unsophisticated person making meth, say, in the backyard or the woods or wherever they were. Those are gone now. Those easy targets aren't there anymore.
Yeah, particularly with meth, quite a few officers that I talked with, you know, said if you go back around a decade ago, Wisconsin was having meth problems, especially in northwestern Wisconsin. And back in that day, a lot of meth was coming out of home labs or was kind of community grown. But these days, they're really not seeing that as much. A lot of it is being shipped into the state through large cities. In some cases, law enforcement agents said they believe it's coming across the border. But their point is that there are very large operations involved in bringing drugs into the state, and these are no longer kind of small operations that if you were to, you know, arrest a small homegrown drug dealer, that it would have as much impact in the community.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Diane is on the line in Bayview. Diane, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Diane?
Yes, I just wanted to make a quick comment. What I've observed, my daughter is now incarcerated. She's a drug user. She's an addict and on heroin. And these kids or adults are going to do what they need to do to get the drugs, which is steal. And it's easier for the law enforcement to get these people doing those crimes than it is the drug dealers. So they get these kids who commit these crimes, stick them in jail. They're found guilty, they stick them in prison or they're out on bail. And if they don't get the treatment while they're in there, what they need, they're going to come back out and they're going to do it again.
Diane, thanks for sharing your story, your family story. Sorry you're going through this difficult time with your daughter. Keegan, a lot there. First of all, I mean, it kind of makes sense. There are more users, presumably, than dealers. They're easier to find, especially if they're committing other crimes to support their habit. So it makes sense that they'd be, in some ways, easier targets for law enforcement.
Yeah, exactly. I think an important point here is that some places around the state have set up drug courts that are specifically designed to bring people into treatment programs. And there's widespread or increasing recognition that law enforcement agencies cannot just arrest people and send them back to the street and expect that they're going to be better, particularly with drug addiction. You know, I've heard the Attorney General say that. I've heard police chiefs say that around the state. I've heard prosecutors say that. I think what's maybe different than a decade or two decades ago is that there was some reluctance in the past to arrest users because people worried that it wasn't really addressing the problem. Now, because of these drug courts, you know, I've heard prosecutors encourage police to arrest people who are just users because then they can steer them into drug addiction programs.
Diane, thanks again for the call. And a hope, I guess, in law enforcement would be that if you arrest the user, you can get information about their dealer and then kind of work your way up the pyramid. That's easier said than done, it looks like, from your writing, Keegan.
Right. So I've the Attorney General and other people have told me that the way drug networks are designed these days is that a lot of drug users don't really know much information about their drug dealers. And so even if they wanted to cooperate with police and provide them information, there isn't a lot of information for police to really go on there. So it can provide these frustrating blocks to really understand how these drug networks are working.
We're talking to Keegan Kyle right now about his investigation into why the state is addressing arresting more drug users over time while arresting fewer or the same number of drug dealers as in the past. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin.
And you can share your thoughts by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of users facing more arrests than dealers in some cases in the state? How do you think law enforcement should handle these crimes? Has anyone in your family experienced this? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to join the conversation.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation about drug users bearing the brunt of arrests compared with dealers in Wisconsin. Keegan Kyle is with us. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's been following that story.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the state should prioritize? What do you think local governments and police departments should prioritize when it comes to drug law enforcement? Is this an issue that's affected you and your family, your community? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Michael is with us in Duluth, Minnesota. Michael, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Michael?
So I work as a correctional officer, and I see it time and time again that the drug users who are in their 20s or even 30s have very little to zero motivation to stop the bad behavior or to get out of that environment. And it's not until they reach their 50s, pretty much, when family members start dying, they realize how much they're losing by focusing on drugs that they even make any changes in their lives.
Well, do you see any interventions where you work, Michael, that might help, given that you see this lack of motivation to change?
I do see some. There are drug treatment programs inside prison. There are, you know, church groups and whatnot that come and volunteer. But the ones that do take advantage of those, once again, they're older, or they're doing it almost purely for the reduced sentences from it.
Michael, thanks for the call. And Keegan, I don't know if this kind of data was there with the drug arrest numbers you were looking at. Do we have any kind of age breakdown on what we're talking about here?
No, the data that I have doesn't look at age, but one kind of related data set is looking, that I mentioned in the story, is looking at hepatitis C infections. So years ago, hepatitis C was this bloodborne infection, this virus that was predominant among people, above age 30. But there's been this surge of new infections among people in their early 20s, and health officials predominantly attribute that to rise in drug use, and particularly sharing needles. And it's become a huge problem in the state that health authorities and also some correctional officers are now trying to deal with this year.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michael. We'll go next to Don on the line in Madison. Don, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think, Don?
So I am a recovering user, and it took me a long time to get sober. I ended up going to prison for about 2 years, and during that time was offered very little treatment to have options out or to help me find sobriety or get out of prison and actually be able to live a life. Luckily, I was able to do that in the end, near the very end of my sentence, I did some sort of treatment in prison. But it's you have to get a lucky card to be able to get into that kind of stuff. And the prisons are so overcrowded that you have a very little chance of getting in there. And if you do, it gets taken away very easily.
Luckily,
I was able to get in.
Don, thanks for sharing your story. I hope you hold on to that lucky card for a good long while. Keegan, as you talk to law enforcement officials and others, is that part of the story? Are they talking just about who are we arresting, or are they talking more about what happens? Do they have options after they're arrested?
Yeah, they're both talking about both of those issues, particularly with these drug treatment courts are designed at kind of the local level to steer people into treatment programs. There are also now new programs at the state prison level that are trying to help people with treatment recovery. I'm not too familiar with it, but I believe there's a Department of Corrections program that is helping people really at the process at the end when they're about to be released into a community to help them with addiction and to find more stability as they head back out into the community and more independence.
Thanks a lot for that call, Don, and good luck to you. Keegan, I want to get into a couple more points in your reporting before we're done. You looked at Wausau and saw that it's kind of an outlier in some ways to some of the trends around the state. What did you see there?
Yeah, Wausau is really interesting in that their police department and some of the surrounding agencies have really seen a rise in arrests, not only for drug possession, but also for drug users. They've been very aggressive. According to their arrest statistics, over the past 3 years, they've made more drug arrests for possession and sales than they have in the previous decade. And what's really interesting about them is they believe it's working. They've received a lot of praise from the community that what they're doing is making a difference. But like other parts of the state, they're still seeing problems. And you know, they would take a heroin dealer off the street and see that person in the drug market kind of replaced by a meth dealer. And so they're constantly having to kind of respond and react to the shifting community.
And they're fighting economics there. In some ways, you write that we're in a more saturated community that's had a long-time heroin problem. What might sell for $10 in a place like Wausau with less competition might bring in 5 or 6 times that much. So there's kind of a natural draw for those dealers to be replaced as they're arrested.
Right. And I heard that similarly for not only Wausau, but other kind of smaller cities that you might not expect to have a lot of drug activity, but they do in part because dealers see that as a lucrative market with less competition.
I guess a big question here, Keegan, as we start to wrap up, you talked about the increasing sophistication of people dealing mainly heroin and meth, doing things that make it harder for police to track their networks and arrest them. Do law enforcement officials see light at the end of the tunnel? Are they going to be able to keep up in this kind of arms race with the people they're trying to arrest?
Well, the Attorney General and others really encouraged the need for additional resources. The Attorney General was approved by the state lawmakers to receive 4 new drug agents this year to address drug trafficking, but he told me that would not be enough to address the problem, and he would advocate for more. Similarly, local law enforcement agencies said that they don't really see, they still see continuing problems, I guess is their big point, and that this is something that is going to require continuing attention.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Keegan, what unanswered questions are you still hoping to find data on?
Well, I'd still like to learn more about those big dealers. Who are they? How often are they being arrested? How much impact are those types of arrests really having in communities?
We'll leave it there. Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Keegan Kyle. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about his recent report looking at the rates of arrests in the state when it comes to drug-related incidents. We've heard some stories from you on the air. You can still share your stories. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know how this issue has affected you, your family, and your community. ¶¶
The Toronto-based company Aquila Resources plans to mine gold, zinc, and other metals in Michigan upstream from the Menominee River. So far, the mining company has been able to obtain nearly all the permits needed to move forward. As the project nears final approval, Danielle Kading reports on the tension it's created among residents along the Michigan-Wisconsin border.
On this Friday evening, cars honk in support of protesters who stand on a street corner in Menominee, just across the border from Marinette. Dale Burry of McAllister, Wisconsin, is among them. He's president of the newly formed Coalition to Save the Menominee River. Burry says the Back 40 mine poses too great a threat to the region's economy, environment, and public health.
My land is 228 feet from the Menominee River, and so we would definitely be affected.
Tina Lesperance of Stevenson, Michigan, stands nearby in an outfit resembling the Grim Reaper. She's holding a sign that says cyanide kills. The chemical is used in a diluted form to extract gold from ore as part of the mining process. Lesperance says that's just one reason she opposes the project.
I'm very fearful that the Menominee River will be poisoned with acid mine drainage, which is actually sulfuric acid. It'll kill the fish, it'll kill the birds, anything that comes in contact with it.
Protests like this one have been held outside the Ogden Club in Menominee since the spring. Lesperance says they gather here because of the club's ties to the mine.
The people that own the Ogden Club are investors of the mine, and there were also employees that worked for Aquila. So we want to bring awareness to people that this business is behind the mine.
Inside, customers chat over drinks and food. Ogden Club co-owner Robin Quigley recently retired as a spokeswoman for the mining company. She declined to comment on the protests. Quigley says she and her husband Tom own a fraction of the company's shares and have leased space to Aquila for meetings about the project. Waitress Jennifer Dulick says the controversy around the mine has ruined a lot of friendships.
I have a lot of friends that are protesting right outside here while I'm trying to work and make money and support my family, and it sucks, I guess.
Dulick says she made roughly $700 a week in tips last year. Now she says she's lucky if she can make half that.
We've had a few employees like walking down the street, coming to work, wearing our Ogden Club shirts and yelling stuff at us. No back party mine, and just kind of being rude.
Several customers at the Ogden Club say they would support the mine if it can be built without harming the environment and public health. They say the project would create hundreds of mining jobs, millions in tax revenues, and help stem the region's population loss. But the mine is so controversial here that supporters declined to speak on tape. Aquila Resources spokeswoman Shantae Lassard understands their silence.
They don't want their businesses, for example, to be protested at. I think that once we get all of our permits, you will see a lot more visual support for the project. But right now, people just want to stay private. They don't want the attention that this project brings from those who oppose mining.
The company just resubmitted its application for a wetlands permit to Michigan regulators. Aquila's Lassard says they hope a final permit will be issued to them in January. But protesters like Tina Lesperance hope Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality will reject it.
And if they don't, we're not going to stop. We're going to do everything in our power to stop them.
With so much at stake, emotions are running high. One man driving by the club screams at protesters to get a job. Later in the evening, Ogden Club co-owner Robin Quigley reads a retirement card she was given by mine opponents. Inside are snide remarks like rest in peace, spelled P-I-E-C-E, and worst of luck. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up later on, WPR reporter Bridget Bowden spent nearly 6 months embedded with a class of recruits at the Madison Police Department. Her documentary, New in Blue, looks at the recruits, their training, and the people they'll be policing. You can listen online at WPR.org/policeacademy.
And coming up next hour on Central Time, we'll have our next installment in our week-long series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. Our focus today is on the arts, including writing for young adults and music. You can find archived interviews, articles, slideshows, and more from the series. Just head over to WPR.org/first.
The FDA had bad news this week for an East Coast bakery. According to a letter from the FDA to the Neshoba Brook Bakery in Concord, Massachusetts, the word love is not an ingredient.
The bakery lists the word love in the ingredients list of its granola. The FDA maintains that ingredients need to be recognized by their common and usual name and actually be ingredients, I guess, and love is not one of those.
It's a tricky one. I kind of like it when, I think it's sort of folksy when, purveyors of food that I like to eat list the word love. You're always saying that it's part of this famed chicken shawarma recipe that you're constantly grinding spices and telling us about.
I've never actually claimed that there's love in any recipe I've ever made. There is, work and time, but no love. But yeah, I've seen that on, different brands of food, love or lots and lots of love. I think I saw one. And yeah, I guess the FDA here is saying, you can't quantify it. There's no chemical composition. Somebody was saying earlier, is there more or less love than FDA dye yellow number three or whatever? So no. But I mean, you could still say, on the label, granola made with lots of love.
Yeah.
Just don't put it on the ingredients list.
I don't know. I still think it's kind of cute.
I could go either way. I don't know. How about with surliness? Because I sometimes cook with surliness. I put that on my ingredients list.
Made with antagonism and surliness. Brought to you from Central Time.
Yeah, 10% more love. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.